We're beginning the book of Shmuel. Shmuel is quite possibly the most phenomenal person that ever lived. Shmuel is equated with both Moshe and Aharon. Meaning, we say, Moshe v'Aharon b'Kohanav u'Shmuel b'Korei Shemo. So Shmuel is a giant. And Shmuel is really the connector between the period of the Shoftim to the period of kings. He might be the final Shofet. So we're beginning the book of Shmuel, and our story begins... What? The beginning of book of Shmuel. Our story begins with Elkanah, the descendant of Korach. One of the reasons Korach allowed himself to fight Moshe Rabbeinu was because he had a vision that he would have Shmuel coming out of him. So he felt, if I have such greatness coming from me, I'm not going to lose. He was wrong. His children didn't lose. He lost. So Elkanah is the leader of the Jewish people. He is a prophet. And Elkanah travels around Israel. Every time he travels a different route. And this way he encourages people. He reminds people of the importance of learning Torah, of ascending up to Shiloh. And during this period, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, was Eli, and he had two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, who were under him. They were Kohanim, they were priests over there in Shiloh. And Elkanah has two wives. He has Pnina with her 10 children, and he has Chana. And Chana has no children, and he loves Chana. And the other wife, Pnina, would consistently tease Chana. She would tease her with the intent of getting her to pray more fervently so that she has children, but she would really hurt her. She'd be like, you know, there's a great sale on kids' clothing. Oh, right, you don't have kids, I'm sorry. You know, she'd say all kinds of lines like that and really hurt Chana's feelings. And every year they'd have the same scene. And she would cry so bitterly she wouldn't eat, even though they'd go up there and serve sacrifices, Chana wouldn't eat. And Elkanah would tell her, why do you cry? Why won't you eat? Why do you feel so bad? I love you more than all 10 children that Pnina gave me. And I try to be better to you than all 10 children. And obviously Chana isn't comforted. And after eating and drinking, she goes out and she's embittered and she starts praying. She's weeping as she prays, and she says, God, you have all these armies in heavens. You can't give me one kid? God, if you don't see my prayer, you're going to see. I'm going to go off with another man, and my husband Elkanah is going to see me going off into a room with another man, and he's going to warn me, don't go into that room. Don't be alone with that man. And then I'm going to do it again. And then he's going to bring me and make me drink the sota waters. And you promise in your Torah that if a woman didn't sin when she was alone with that other man, then you're going to make her pregnant, and then you're going to be forced to give me a child. Chana says to Hashem, God, everything you created has a purpose. You created me with the capacity to nurse a child. Physically, I'm created like a woman. Why? Why can't I nurse a child? Give me a child. So she's crying, and she's praying, and she's speaking very forcefully towards heaven. And she says, if you remember me, and you give me a child that's not exceptional. I don't need everyone to look at him and be jealous of him. She ends up getting an exceptional child. I will give him, I will dedicate him to Hashem, and he will never shave his hair. He will be a Nazir, separate from people, pure for you. And she is praying, and Eli sees her standing there moving her lips. And from Chana we learn this Kabbalistic concept that when one prays, you shouldn't hear their prayer. Their prayer should be just audible to themselves and not to anyone else. And Eli sees her shaking. And remember, in those days, you didn't have any juice. What you were drinking was either water or wine. So it wasn't so far-fetched to think that she had a little bit too much wine and she was tipsy. So he sees her shaking and moving her lips. And she's a famous woman. She's the wife of the chief rabbi, the Elkanah and Eli just became the Kohen Gadol. Today he was appointed high priest. And he says to her, till when, lady, will you walk around drunk? Remove your wine from upon you. It's prohibited to enter the temple with wine. And Hannah looks at him and says, you're not a master of prophecy, are you? Meaning, on his breastplate, the letters that lit up were Kaf Shin Resh Hey. So he thought it was saying Shikora, she's drunk. Really, it said Kishera or Kisara, she's like Sarah, she's a barren woman, she's embittered. She says, you know, I've got a bittered spirit, I didn't drink any wine, I was pouring my heart before Hashem. But don't you look down at me next to the other wife, because I'm upset, so that's why I spoke harshly to you until now. But I'm upset. So Eli says, go in peace, and Hashem should grant your wish that you asked of him. So he gives her a blessing that her prayers should come true. And she thanks him, she goes her way, she's not upset anymore. They go back home, and then Elkanah is intimate with his wife. And from here we learn the halacha that one is not supposed to be intimate when he's using someone else's linen, when he's traveling. It's not modest that someone else should see on his linen any residue, any sign that one was intimate with one's wife. Now, Halacha expects that intimacy is just that. It's intimate. No one else is supposed to know about it. It's something we're supposed to keep modest. And so when a person is traveling, if he's not traveling with his own linen, he is not supposed to be intimate using someone else's linen. He's not supposed to leave any signs where other people would know what happened. So that's what the Pasuk says. He came back home, and then Elkanah knew his wife Chana, and Hashem remembered her. When did Hashem remember her? So these are one of the people which the Talmud tells us were remembered on Rosh Hashanah, right? Why? This is what we read on Rosh Hashanah. This story of Chana is what we read on Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, three women were remembered, so to speak. It was decided they would have children: Sarah, Rachel, and Chana. So she has a child and she names him Shimuel, which means I borrowed him from Hashem. And when Elkanah goes up to bring his sacrifices, Chana doesn't go up. She says, I'm going to wait till the child is weaned, and then I'm bringing him up and he's going to remain there. Remember, he's a Levite and she took her vow. So she says, fine, as you wish. So when he's weaned, she brings him up. She brings sacrifices. And who are the Kohanim at that time? Eli's children, Hophni and Pinchas. And they were in it for themselves, as we're going to see in a minute. And so when it comes time to do the service and slaughter the animals, so they couldn't find any Kohen. So Shmuel's a kid over there, and he started to learn. And Shmuel says, what are we waiting? Why is my Ima waiting? So they said, well, you need a Kohen here to slaughter the animal. So Shmuel says, no, you don't. Anyone could slaughter that animal. So they said, what do you mean? The Kohen has to do the service. He said, no, only after the slaughtering do you need a Kohen. The Torah says, when the Torah says a Kohen does the service, the Torah describes the Kohen doing the service after the slaughtering. It says, slaughter the animal, and then says, the Kohen shall. So you see, the Kohen is only brought in after the slaughtering. So they said, that's an interesting thought. They bring him up to Elkanah. And Elkanah says, son, you're right. But you're not allowed to give halachic ruling when the chief rabbi is present. I'm here at the temple. So if you're so smart, you should realize it's also punishable with the death penalty. So Chana gets really upset because the death penalty at the hands of heaven, it says, is only administered to someone from 20 years and up. But that 20 years is a gauge of intellect. And if he was so sharp that he was teaching everyone else halachos at this young age, he was a child prodigy, so then technically he was punishable by the courts of heaven. So Chana comes begging him and says, I'm the woman. So he says, what do you want from me? He did it, and you want, I'll pray, you should have another child. She says, no, I prayed for this one. And God gave it to me, forgive him and pray he should live. So, and anyways, it's not mine. I took a vow that he'd be dedicated to God his whole life. So, I don't know if he prays or what, but Shmuel isn't hurt, and he remains there. And from here we learn another halacha. Ordinarily we have a halachos of respect that one owes his Rebbe. his Rebbe who taught him most of his Torah. Just like one has to respect his parent, one has to respect the Rebbe who taught him most of his Torah. From here we learn halacha that that applies not only to one's Rebbe who taught him most of his Torah, but also if there's a giant in the generation that's considered like the chief rabbi of everyone, like Eli was at that time, so then one owes him that respect as well. One of the laws of respect is that one may not give ruling in front of him. If he's present, you're not allowed to give halachic ruling. Why are you talking in front of him? So really, Shmuel hadn't yet met Eli. He wasn't yet his disciple. He's going to be his disciple, but he wasn't yet. So why did he owe him any honor? The idea is that if one is considered the chief teacher of all of Israel, so then everyone owes him that honor as though he's their personal Rebbe. And then we have what the Navi calls the prayer of Chana. It's commonly known as Shirat Chana, the song of Chana, in which Chana describes how now she has salvation, she can sing, Hashem saved her, none are holy like Hashem, none are reliable like Hashem, none are painters like Hashem. When I was studying Chulin, Tractate Chulin discusses the laws of how you slaughter an animal and which parts of the animals have to be removed, which fats are kosher, which are non-kosher, and then what type of blemishes within an animal would disqualify it from being kosher. So we learn all about the lungs and the different parts, the different components of the stomach of an animal. And our Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Beryl Wein, bought very expensive in those days, back when a dollar was worth something. This goes back in two or three decades ago. He bought a cow that was painted, a plastic cow, that was painted the exact color of what a real cow looked like. And you could take it apart, and every part could be taken apart into smaller parts. You could literally take it apart part after part. You could take apart the liver, and then take apart the little parts of the liver, and now you take apart the heart, and take apart the ventricles of the heart, and take apart the lungs, and then take apart the different parts of the lungs. And this way we learned, and each part of the cow was painted specifically with the exact color that a real cow looked like. So that after I studied that cow for a whole summer, I spent two months studying Tractate Chulin with that cow, taking it apart, putting it back together again, I could take apart a cow. Meaning I went to a slaughtering house and I was able to recognize every part of the cow. Because it was literally, they painted every part identically. And even the veins on the inside of the lungs and every part I could recognize.
How big was this model cow?
This big, like the size of the table. So really, I mean, relatively big. So Chana describes Hashem as Ein Tzur Kelokeinu. There's no rock like Hashem. Our tradition is that she was alluding to another idea. Ein Tzayar Kelokeinu. There's no painter like Hashem. That everything is a painting within a painting within a painting. Meaning ordinarily you paint the painting. You want to sculpt, you sculpt the... Here, when Hashem creates something, there's the external color, there's the internal color. We don't see the blood running through our veins. We don't see all the color scheme that's within the body. All the different colors of the green gallbladder, the brown liver, the red lungs, the dark red heart. We don't see any of that. But Hashem is a painter within a painter. Hashem paints things within things. Chana is really focusing her song against people who are haughty. She's focusing her song about how the other wife, Pnina, kept mocking her and saying, where are you, where am I? And we have a tradition that with every child that Chana had, Pnina lost two children. And it reached a point where Chana had seven children. And when Pnina was down to her last two, she ran to Chana and begged Chana as she saw Chana pregnant again and said, pray that my last two don't die. And she prayed for her and they didn't die. There's a phenomenal thought that's said over here. The Talmud tells us that the angel of death, Satan, in the book of Job, and Pnina in our story, both meant for the sake of heaven. Even though they were both afflicting someone, they both meant for the sake of heaven. The angel, Satan was intent on getting Job to grow, or whatever the reason was, the Talmud discusses. And Penina was intent on helping Chana express herself more powerfully, and then Chana would merit to have children. So there's a comment that said, it, I don't think it has any basis in our sages, but the thought is still a good, an important thought. How did they know that Penina meant for the sake of heaven? The verse says that Penina, the Penina tormented her. That's what it says. So how did they know she meant for the sake of heaven? So the truth is, if you look closely at the verse, there is an allusion to it. It says, "Ba'avu ha'ra'ima." Her intent was to arouse her. What does that mean? So you could say it means to arouse her anger. You could say it means to arouse her prayers. There's a way of seeing it within between the lines anyways. But there's a thought that said that the way one can tell it was done for the sake of heaven is because it was extraordinarily cruel. And there are levels of cruelty that could only be attained when you're doing them for the sake of heaven. How else does a person torment a woman like that? So that's something to think about. Elkanah comes home and Shmuel is staying there apprenticing under Eli. And
I have a question.
Yeah.
So because Penina is, even though her intentions were for the sake of heaven, but her actions resulted in, you know, punishment, like, you know, the death of children and stuff, that means that we have no right to, you know, try to maybe motivate someone through tormentation, correct?
Right.
Okay.
It deserves broader discussion, but in general, yes. We did have a broader discussion when we learned it in Ein Yaakov, where the Talmud in Brachos discusses this. The Talmud in Brachos says this calculation of what Penina was thinking and the price Penina paid, and there we went into it. But yeah, in general, that's correct.
But what if the level obviously wasn't as so much as tormentation of as Penina's relationship was with Chana? But what if it's something, okay, you know, you're a commander in the army and you have this soldier and you might motivate them while they're running and say, like, what, you think this is anything? Come on, like, you're nothing, show me what you got, you know, and try to bring out the best in them through teasing them in that kind of way.
So, I'll tell you two things. Number one, a person always has to ask himself, is this the easier way for him to accomplish the result? Or is it really the best way for the other person? So that's question number one. Point number two, many years ago, a decade and a half ago, I was teaching in an orphan. Okay, and the kid didn't have a father. He did have a mother, but the Torah says there's a biblical prohibition not to torment an orphan, right? And the Torah says worse, that one who does is risking his own life, that Hashem listens very closely when an orphan cries. And there are many psukim that stress how potent it is, the punishment that one can get if one hurts an orphan. Now, I felt that this kid needed to be yelled at. I felt that the most correct thing for him in order to continue educating him was to yell at him. But I was scared of yelling at him. The kid's an orphan, right? So I went to the head of the kollel in Tiferes Yerushalayim at the time, and I asked him, what does he say? What am I supposed to do? So he said, look, you got to look at it like this. You have a kid who's playing with a firecracker. So we all know that firecrackers can blow off a finger. Then you have a kid who's playing with dynamite. So sometimes you have to use dynamite because dynamite is a very important tool. But you have to realize that it's dynamite. So when you're dealing with an orphan, you're dealing with dynamite. So you have to make sure you're doing things accurately to get it exactly right. So I would extrapolate from that the same idea. If you think that to help someone grow, you have to hurt them, you have to realize you're playing with fire. Is it sometimes right? Sometimes. But you have to realize that it's very, very dangerous. And you see that Penina paid a hefty price. She lost almost all her kids over this. So it's very risky. I can tell you I didn't end up doing it. I chickened out. I looked for a different way of educating the kid, and I didn't I didn't feel I could trust my judgment to be like a surgeon to cut exactly what needs to be cut and get it right. So I didn't. But okay, that's not to say that was the right choice. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Every circumstance you have to gauge, but you have to realize if you're considering doing something that'll hurt someone's feelings and it's for the right intent, you have to really, really know what you're doing.
What's really strange about that, though, is these spiritual giants we talk about, both Penina and, first of all, Penina, people named their kids Penina, so there must have been something positive about her somewhere. I saw Jezebel. Okay.
Right, right.
On the other hand, the people that you said, we have just a very similar story. When the husband, who is this giant, right, Elkanah, Yaakov, seemed to so much favor the other wife, in this case Hannah, and in the other case Leah, the wives who were rejected by their husbands somewhat really were nasty at times to the favored wife. You saw that. But it seems so too simplistic. Here, this guy's on this level, you can't... It seems that he makes such seemingly glaring mistakes by showing such obvious favoritism. One seems so much loved than the other.
I don't know that he showed favoritism. It says that he would try to put on a broader smile to comfort Hannah.
Right. Aren't I more than you than 10, and you're my most favorite? Certainly Rachel seemed that Leah thought she was the most favorite. I mean, I don't know. It just seems, I don't think we're reading it. I don't think I'm reading it right when I look at these people as just, yes, they're human beings, but, to say that they didn't know how to parent properly, they made big time mistakes, husband, maybe they did, but I think I'm missing something. It's like this week we read about Tamar and that thing too, coming home from sheep shearing festival, side of the road. I mean, it's not the, it's Yehuda we're talking, not, guy coming home with a few pops from the local, it just doesn't make sense. I don't know.
Okay, so it deserves a broader introduction and broader class.